Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
That's right, it's your favorite professor here. Listen, Buzzkillers, July 4th is upon us, and two things will likely happen, at least for American Buzzkillers. The first is that we'll use the July 4th national holiday as an opportunity to take a midsummer vacation or an extended weekend vacation. The second thing that will happen is that we'll be treated to a great number of canned, poorly researched, and even more poorly argued soundbite stories about the Declaration of Independence from a lot of traditional media outlets. And of course, the same type of thing will happen over email, social media, and podcasts. Not this podcast, but other lesser podcasts. No doubt, some of the stories we'll hear will be good and solidly based, but historical urban legends have only been enhanced by social media, and their spread and influence have been greatly boosted by mass emailings and Facebook posts put up carelessly and, perhaps worse, reposted and forwarded in a knee-jerk way, without any thought to whether the content of these posts have any evidence at all behind them. For instance, we'll hear that John Hancock, he of the big signature, quipped to the assembled delegates after he signed the Declaration so hugely, "There, King George will be able to read that without his spectacles." And we'll be told by an email myth that will not die that essentially the British Army went around during the Revolutionary War rounding up signers of the Declaration of Independence and marked them for special punishment and torture. Here in this episode, we're going to examine some of the history of the Declaration of Independence, the complications in that history, and whether any of the things your crazy uncle sends in those emails or your nutty aunt posts on Facebook are true. And we'll give you the ammunition to fight your own revolutionary battle against historical myths, myth makers, and myth spreading. First of all, why did the American colonies and colonists need a declaration of independence? After all, the colonies, more or less united, had been at war with Great Britain since April 1775 and had certainly witnessed deteriorating relations with the mother country since 1765. Tensions increased in the mid-1770s, and the colonists met in the First Continental Congress in Philadelphia in October 1774 to discuss how they, together, should respond to pressure from the British government to agree to new colonial taxes and trade regulations. They agreed to boycott British goods and to demand repeal of the coercive acts passed by Parliament to punish Massachusetts for the Boston Tea Party in 1773. Neither of these things lessened the British Parliament's desire to clamp down on colonial discontent, and so a second Continental Congress was called in 1775, to manage the war against the crown and discuss whether the colony should declare full independence from Great Britain. The Second Continental Congress debated these matters off and on for a year before deciding to pass an independence resolution. Two significant things prompted the actual Declaration of Independence. The first was the delegates' realization that they needed to declare themselves an independent nation in order to get foreign help for the Revolutionary War. The other great European powers might help a revolt by Britain's American colonies, but these countries had their own colonies, and messing around with the British colonial system might invite British retaliation against their own colonial systems. A colonial war wasn't something to be entered into lightly. The second thing was the influence that Englishman Thomas Paine and his publications had on supporters of the American complaints against the British Crown and Empire. Although many of the Founding Fathers thought Paine wasn't as sophisticated and careful a thinker as they were, his work was becoming popular among the chattering classes in the colonies, and many in the Continental Congress thought that they should jump on the Paine bandwagon. They urged other members of the Continental Congress to consider the Paine-esque public relations value of a major and strong statement through a declaration of independence. Now, it took a few months for the delegates to the Second Continental Congress to overcome disagreements between themselves in early 1776, but by the end of June, they had agreed not only to declare independence, but to publish the declaration and the reasons why. They voted that way on July 2nd, and some delegates, including John Adams, thought that July 2nd would be known as Independence Day because that's when the question of independence was decided. But it took a couple of more days for some of the textual details to be hammered out, and it was resolved on July 4th to finish the document and send it to be printed. But even then, it wasn't the final version that we all know and love. In the first place, the actual July 4th document was typeset and printed, not published through the engrossing process of creating a facsimile of the handwritten document. More on that in a moment. The first July 4th declaration was printed in Philadelphia and distributed widely. The title read, In Congress, July 4th, 1776, a declaration by the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress assembled. So far, so good, right? That's what we ended up with, right? Well, no. The Declaration of Independence was, for want of a better term, a living document for the next few months, kind of like the Constitution is a living document now because it's been amended a lot. When it came to producing the engrossed, that's the handwritten, copy for printing, the delegates decided to change the wording. They voted on July 19th that resolved that the declaration passed on the 4th be fairly engrossed and on parchment with the title and style of the Unanimous Declaration of the 13 United States of America, and that the same, when engrossed, be signed by every member of Congress. That changed the title from a declaration by the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress assembled to the Unanimous Declaration of the 13 United States of America. They added unanimous to give more solidarity to the sentiments that they were expressing, and it finalized the text that we know today. They also resolved that all the members of Congress, those who had voted on it during the Second Continental Congress, would sign the engrossed version and that their signatures be printed on the copies produced. That was done on August 2nd, 1776. So, buskillers, four dates could have been chosen as America's Independence Day. July 2nd, when independence was agreed to by vote. July 4th, when the first declaration was printed. July 19th, when the introductory text got amended to make it more unanimous, or August 2nd, when most of the delegates actually signed the declaration and in effect pledged, quote, to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor, the phrase which ends the document appears just above the signatures. So the date wasn't exactly engraved in stone. Perhaps, though, the most fun myths and misunderstandings about the Declaration of Independence are related to a couple of reported quips supposedly uttered by John Hancock and Benjamin Franklin. First, let's take John Hancock, who was the president of the Second Continental Congress and whose signature is large and central on the document that we all know. In fact, John Hancock has become a synonym for signature in American culture, as in put your John Hancock right there when you're signing your future away, buying a house or an expensive car. According to one of the myths about Hancock and his signature, he was the first to sign the document, and he said aloud after he signed, "There, I guess King George will be able to read that." And there are variants of this story, and the only thing that changes is what Hancock was supposed to have said after signing his name so hugely and prominently. I've got a few here. King George can read that without his spectacles. There. John Bull can read my name without spectacles and may now double his reward of £500 for my head. That is my defiance. And finally, the British ministry can read that name without spectacles. Let them double their reward. You know what I'm going to say, buzzkillers? There's absolutely no good evidence that Hancock said anything after signing the declaration. The reason that his signature is so central and prominent is that he was the president of the Congress that wrote and approved the Declaration. Similarly, after signing the Declaration, good old Ben Franklin was supposed to have quipped, "There you have it, gentlemen. We must all hang together, or most assuredly we shall all hang separately." Just like the John Hancock quote, this is considered to be an absolute fact, even though there's absolutely no evidence that it happened. And the earliest that this quote appears is the mid-19th century, 50, 60, 70 years after the signing, and in other stories later written about the Founding Fathers. But the biggest myth, and that one that seems to be most persistent, is the famous price they paid myth that flies around email circles every July 4th. Almost invariably, this email comes from your nutty uncle or that slightly crazy guy in the next office over, who's always spreading these kind of historical myths via email without bothering to check even a grade school encyclopedia. Now, I debated over how best to present the myth to you, whether to read out the entire email and then show where it's wrong, or to analyze it claim by claim. And I decided on the latter because I was afraid that reading out the whole text without interruption might be mistaken for reading out an accurate history of what happened to the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence. So we'll take the price they paid email apart piece by piece. But the first thing I want to say is that there are some general fallacies and falsehoods that run through the whole thing that should caution any good buzzkiller when reading a document such as this. And by document, I mean the email, not the Declaration of Independence. In the first place, there's the common fallacy that operates like this. Because person A committed act X in 1776, and then years later was captured by the enemy, doesn't mean that they were targeted for capture because they committed act X, or that they had their property damaged mainly because they committed act X. The price they paid starts this way. Five signers, it says, were captured by the British as traitors and tortured before they died. Well, yes. Four signers of the Declaration of Independence were captured by the British during the Revolutionary War. George Walton, Thomas Hayward, Arthur Middleton, and Edward Rutledge. But there's no evidence that they were captured or targeted specifically because they signed the Declaration of Independence. They were captured as, if you will, normal prisoners of war when fighting against the British, and they were not tortured while prisoners, and they did not die while they were POWs. Richard Stockton of New Jersey was captured by the British because he signed the Declaration of Independence, but technically speaking, he was captured by local British sympathizers, Tories, and turned over to the British Army. Here's one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. These are local people. This all happened on November 30th, 1776. Stockton was thrown in jail and kept in deplorable conditions until released in mid-1777, and his health was utterly ruined. 12 signers had their homes ransacked and burned, the price they paid continues. And several signers, the Declaration, had their property destroyed during the Revolutionary War, but again, it wasn't because they were targeted as signers of the Declaration of Independence, but because that property was either in the path of battle or because it was captured, occupied, and destroyed by one of the marauding armies, British or colonial. What's that, Professor? One of the armies? Yes. The big houses owned by prominent lawyers and politicians were captured and commandeered by both the British and the American forces as the battles of the Revolutionary War raged, depending on who needed them most and who was in the strongest position to capture the property. The property was the important thing while the battle was raging, not whether so-and-so had signed the Declaration of Independence. Another price they paid, quote, two signers lost their sons serving in the Revolutionary Army, and another had two sons captured. Again, this is partly true. Abraham Clark from New Jersey had two sons captured and imprisoned on a ship. John Witherspoon, also from New Jersey, had his eldest son killed at the Battle of Germantown, but the other son killed during the war has yet to be identified. No one knows whether it actually happened. And again, there's no evidence that any of these sons of Declaration signers were targeted because their fathers had signed the document. From all the available evidence, they were part of the, if you will, normal flow of the Revolutionary War. 9 of the 56 signers fought and died from wounds or hardships of the Revolutionary War, is the next claim in the price they paid. Technically, this is true, but buzzkillers across the nation and the world recognize a misleading statement when they hear it. Yes, 9 signers of the Declaration of Independence died during the Revolutionary War, but they did not die from war wounds or from deprivations caused by the war. At least none of them died as a result of injuries inflicted directly or indirectly by the British. The only founding father who died from wounds received during the Revolutionary War, I shouldn't say founding father, I should say the only signer of the Declaration of Independence who died from wounds of the during the Revolutionary War, was Button Gwinnett from Georgia. But even his wounds were from a fellow Continental officer who shot him in a duel in May 1777. Not only does the price they paid claim that the signers of the Declaration of Independence either lost their lives or had their sons killed by the British, it also says their property and livelihoods were ruined by the British. Again, these claims are either untrue or greatly exaggerated. Carter Braxton of Virginia did indeed have his fleet of merchant ships captured by the British Navy, but there's no evidence that he was targeted because he signed the Declaration of Independence, and he certainly didn't die penniless, as the story goes on to claim. The same is true of Thomas McKean, whose treatment during the Revolutionary War not only can't be attributed to the fact that he signed the Declaration of Independence, but can be attributed to the fact that he was a volunteer leader of colonial militia forces. And the same is true of 8 signers who were listed having their property looted. Again, there's no evidence that the looters or marauding armies targeted the signers of the Declaration of Independence when moving through the regions they captured. And finally, the price they paid gets personal. But I gotta tell you, there's no evidence that Francis Lewis's wife was captured by the British and held because he was a signatory to the Declaration. She was captured along with other civilians on Long Island and held by the British looking for a deal whereby wives of British officers could be exchanged for colonial civilians. And that's eventually what happened. The price they paid even claims that, quote, John Hart, New Jersey, was driven from his wife's bedside as she was dying. Their 13 children fled for their lives. His fields and his grist mill were laid to waste. For more than a year, he lived in forests and caves, returning to his home to find his wife dead and his children vanished. A few weeks later, he died from exhaustion and a broken heart. Well, by the time that the British captured Hart's part of New Jersey in late 1776, his wife was already dead, having succumbed to a long-standing illness several weeks earlier. And all his children were grown and off on their own by then. Further, he lived well into 1779 and served in the New Jersey Assembly in the intervening years. So that's not true either. There's no evidence for that. It's just turning everything on its head. Certainly, buzzkillers, signing the Declaration of Independence was a brave act, and each of the delegates to the Continental Congress knew the significance of what he was doing. But how did these false stories get circulated? Well, the best that Buzzkill Institute historians can do is trace it back to Paul Harvey, the famous radio commentator who used to come up with the rest of the story. He published this rest of the story, the price they paid story, in a 1956 book with that very title, The Rest of the Story. But where he got it from, or whether he came up with it on his own, is impossible to say. What is possible to say is that Paul Harvey's popularity on the radio meant that when political talk radio really took off in the 1980s, this story was picked up by Ann Landers, it was picked up by Rush Limbaugh, later by Pat Buchanan and Oliver North. And it's undoubtedly from them that General Richard B. Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, sent out an Independence Day message that repeated the same story without checking its veracity in 2002. And I expect many of you will hear it this year. But this year you will have also been forewarned. You're a minute man for historical truth. Buzzkill Institute historians and researchers have set you straight. And you're welcome. We'll talk to you next week.